this brings us to step one. Now, I'm a drug addict alcoholic. Now, I've worked successfully with drug addicts and alcoholics. I've worked with gamblers, sex addicts, food addicts, cutters, hoarders, codependents. I don't even share that addiction, yet I'm able to win their confidence and show them a big book solution. How is that possible? And I'm going to share this with you today in this step one presentation just to expand your usefulness to those that suffer. And you're going to find people that come into the rooms of Drug Addicts Anonymous. They may be suffering from alcoholism or drug addiction, but they may have some other addictions going on, like food or sex or some other debilitating addiction pattern that they can't seem to control. So step one says we admitted that we were powerless over alcohol, our drugs, our acting out behavior, that our lives have become unmanageable. Now, what does that mean? What does it mean to be powerless? What does it mean to be unmanageable? How do you know I'm powerless? How do you know my life is unmanageable? How do I know you're powerless? How do I know your life's unmanageable? So in the rooms, we have this process called identification. Now, I've heard all kinds of ways people identify in the rooms. I've had people say, I've been to jail. I've lived on the streets. I've prostituted myself. You know, you may do those things, but that's not what makes us addicts. I'll never forget, a woman said to me once at a meeting, I was facilitating to 150 people, and she goes, I used to suck my dealer's dick for crack. And I said, honey, that doesn't make you an addict. It makes you a cocksucker, but it doesn't make you an addict, right? Now, I know that's kind of a rude way to put it, but that's the kind of shit I hear in the rooms, and that's there can be a disconnect. Some of us may prostitute ourselves, but if you're not doing that, there's going to be a disconnect. I'm an intravenous cocaine user. I like the needle. Now, if I'm working with a marijuana addict and I start talking about how to mix up a rig, are they going to relate? They're going to look at me like I got three bloody heads on and say, well, I'm not like you, right? Even drinking. I'm an everyday bourbon drinker, but I've worked with alcoholics who drink beer only. I've worked with alcoholics who drink wine only. I've worked with binge warriors, weekend warriors, blackout drunks. I've worked with blackout drunks that smoke crack cocaine, not because they're crackheads. They smoke crack cocaine so they can drink longer. So even within a particular addiction pattern, our behavior can vary a lot. So how do we identify in a way that realizes, hey, I'm like you, you're like me, but you don't do it anymore and I want what you got? You know, just because my boss thinks I have a drinking problem because I wore a lampshade on my head at the Christmas office party doesn't make me an alcoholic. Doesn't make me a lamp either. So to identify, and everything I use here is right out of the big book. So there's a passage in the doctor's opinion that says the message which can interest and hold addicted people must have depth and weight. What's the one thing we all share in common, whether we're alcoholics, drug addicts, sex addicts, food addicts, cutters, hoarders, whatever? What's the one thing we all wish we could do, but we can't do? Control it. We can't. We have lack of control, right? Because if any one of us here could control the thing we love to do most, would you be listening to this dickweed talk for the next 4 hours? I don't think so. We'd all be out enjoying what we love to do. Lack of control. That's the depth and weight. That's the hair that we split when we're identifying with one another in the rooms. Now, it goes on to say, tell the newcomers enough about your drinking, using, or acting out habits, symptoms, and experiences, and encourage them to speak of themselves. So I share some stuff. They share some stuff. And we have this understanding about our habits. If you ever work with someone who's outside your addiction pattern, I remember someone came to me who said, I suffer from under-earning. I'd never even heard of it, but there's a real addiction pattern to it. And so I didn't understand it. So I said to them, explain to me what your spree looks like when you're in an under-earning addiction pattern. And they teach me all about their addiction. That just makes me more useful as a sponsor when I encounter that behavior in others. Goes on to say, tell them how baffled you were, how you finally learned that you were sick, right? Y'all remember when you're drinking or using and you realize at some point, I don't drink and use like other people. There's something different about me. I'll never forget it. I used to work the financial districts in downtown Toronto. And during the week, I'd be in a three-piece pinstripe suit And the women will always be in their finest, you know, business attire. And every Friday night, there'd be a party at some posh condominium complex. So I show up, I'm in my suit, and the women are in their dress, you know, outfits. And there's a lot of drinking, and there's a lot of cocaine. This is back in the mid-80s when Escobar was running the cartels, and it was fucking good coke. And so I'm sitting on the sofa, and this guy says to me, he says, "Hey, Cameron, you want a couple lines of coke?" I said, "I'd love a couple lines." So as he's cutting out the lines, I take off my suit jacket, I roll up my sleeve, my arms are full of track marks. I put a rig on the table and I start mixing up my hit, and the party stopped. It went dead fucking quiet. And the hostess walks in and says, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm going to do my lines." She goes, "You can't shoot up like some junkie in the middle of our little party." And I said, "What? What? You're judging me on my delivery system? Is this what we're talking about?" And I was escorted to the door and politely asked to leave. And as I'm leaving, I'm thinking, with my two lines, by the way, I'm thinking, I don't use like these people, right? There's something different about the way I approach drugs and alcohol. Y'all think of that experience in your life, because we all reach it at some point. Give them an account of the struggles. Now, this is an important distinction. Give them an account of the struggles, the failed strategies you made to stop. What does that mean? I'm going to come back to that in a minute and show them the mental twist, how our brains lie to us, which leads to that first drink, first drug, or that first thought or act that puts us on the spree. Now, there's a passage in the doctor's opinion which describes, very aptly describes, every kind of addiction pattern out there, including drugs and alcohol. Men and women drink, use, or act out essentially because they like the effect. Y'all like the effect, right? I love the effect of cocaine. But if you're working with a newcomer and they go, no, I don't like it anymore. What are they really saying? They don't like the consequences, but they love the effect. And that's an important distinction. And if that's your experience, circle yes in your workbook. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, y'all reached a point in your drinking or using where you realize this is injurious to my health and probably the welfare of other people? And if so, circle yes. They cannot differentiate the true from the false. I'll never forget, my sponsor said to me, "Cameron," in the margin, right, "Cameron is a liar." And what do you mean by that? He says, "Well, you got this twist of thinking in your head, this mental blank spot." He goes, "The strange phenomenon that parallels your sound reasoning. I call it the liar. And the liar loves the effect produced by alcohol and drugs, and it doesn't want to give it up. So it built this research institute in my brain called Bullshit Inc. And it researches new ideas and excuses and reasons why this time when I pick up a drug or a drink, somehow, some way, I'm going to control it and enjoy it." Here's the problem. The liar always won the argument. Y'all relate to the liar that lives inside our head? How the hell do we defeat this? It goes on to say, to them, their addict life seems the only normal one. "It is normal for me to be extremely high or drunk. It is not normal for me to be straight." And most addicts have that experience. They prefer to be altered, right? It goes on to say that they are restless, irritable, discontented, bored, depressed, anxious. These are symptoms of our malady. This is the way I am. When I'm not drinking or using, I'm restless, I'm irritable, I'm discontented, I'm bored and depressed, and I don't like feeling that way. So my solution is to drink and to use. Drinking and using is not my problem. It's my solution. Running out is a problem. And in the beginning, it seemed like the answer. Remember when we first discovered drugs and alcohol and that warm hug came over us and went, "Yeah, this is the way I want to feel. This is the answer to my problems," right? And in the beginning, it seemed like the answer. But as the illness rolls out, it starts off with being fun, a luxury I can take or leave, but then it becomes problematic. It's fun with problems. And in the end, it's nothing but problems. And it goes on to say that unless they can again experience a sense of ease and comfort, this is the body allergy kicking in, which comes at once. How do you spell relief? Fast. By a few drinks or drugs, which we see others, the normies, the non-addicts, or what I like to call the muggles, That's a Harry Potter term for non-wizard. My wife's a muggle. Which we see doing it without consequence. It drives me crazy. How can you just have a toke of a joint or just have one drink? It drives me crazy. And then my liar tries to say, yeah, you can do that too, Cameron. And after they succumb to desire again, as so many do, is that your experience? Have you succumbed to the desire again? If so, circle yes. And the phenomenon of craving develops. This is the body allergy. Now it's at a point where there's no luxury. Once I start drinking or using, I'm on this proverbial spree. What Patrick M., great American speaker from Cocaine Anonymous, used to say, smoking crack cocaine is like sex with an 800-pound gorilla, and it's the gorilla that tells you when it's over, right? That's what my spree is like. I'm long done, but it ain't even near done yet. And then we pass through the well-known stages of the spree, the emerging remorseful, the firm resolution not to do it again, right? And we've all done that, right? Made that firm resolution not to do it again. And we mean it with all our hearts. But here's what happens. I know I can't drink or use anymore, but I don't know how to live without it. So I'm told to go to meetings. And unfortunately, I go to one of those meetings, which I call open, disgusting meetings, where there's no solution. It's just group therapy without a therapist, a room full of despondent looking people sharing problem, 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 like an Oprah wine fest. You ever been to one of those meetings? And by the end of the meeting, we're psychological casualties, ready to put a bullet in our head, or worse yet, a bullet in someone else's head. I'd rather masturbate with a handful of broken glass than go to a fucking meeting like that. They're awful meetings, right? I know. I use terrible, terrible, some terrible about a 66-year-old man talking about masturbation. It's just not healthy. But that's my disdain for these groups. And here's what happens in these types of meetings. There's no solution. So I sit there in what I call sobriety, and I dry out. I don't know how to live with the booze and drugs anymore, but I don't want to live without it. And I start getting restless and irritable and discontented and bored and depressed. And the liar comes out of remission, says, hey, we need our solution. The liar always wins the argument, and I succumb to the desire again, and out I go. Now, here's one other thing that happens in the rooms. And some of you may have known some individuals like this. Some people don't relapse. They go into sobriety and they go insane. Out of 47 deaths, 36 were overdoses, 9 took their lives, suicide, hung themselves. Why would someone hang themselves in sobriety? Because they went insane. They didn't know how to live without it. And the suicide rates in 12 steps today is 80 times higher than normal society. An untreated addict in the first 5 years of abstinence is 80 times more likely to take their own life. And it's a problem in the rooms. And some of you may have known some people that have committed suicide. And it goes on to say that if that's your experience, this is repeated over and over. And unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there's very little hope for their recovery. You know, I'm like a dog that returns to its own vomit. You ever seen a dog eat something that makes it foully sick? What does it do? It throws it up, only to eat the vomit. Only to throw it up again, only to eat the vomit. That's what I'm like as an untreated alcoholic drug addict. I'm like a dog that continuously returns to my own vomit. Okay, now that I got all the gross stuff out of the way. Now, this is the horror of step one, right? It is the realization that nothing secular, nothing human is going to stop this train wreck from happening. I will drink. I will use again. And for me to drink or use again is to die. And that's a horrible experience. That's a horrible conclusion to come to. Now, in trying to identify with the newcomer where they go, hey, I'm like you, you're like me, but you don't do it anymore, and I want what you got. I use this analogy. Addicts are like drowning men and women. And if we don't find some way of keeping our heads above water, we're going to drown. So we look for some kind of power to keep our heads afloat. And we notice there are logs floating on the surface. And these logs look like they're capable of keeping our heads above water, but when I reach for one of these logs, I find I can only hold on for maybe a day, a week, a month, a year, maybe a little longer, but at some point the log fails me as a power and I slip and drown. Logs are best described as easier, softer ways, middle of the road solutions, half measures, and human aids. So take a look at the top of page 5. This is what I call my log and loser list. Now, I'm not going to go through it all, but when you get a chance, take some time and go through it. This is my my modus operandi as an untreated addict. This is my rap sheet. Now, the logs are the easier, softer ways, the middle-of-the-road solutions. Remember, it says in our instructions, give them an account of the struggles you made to stop. Our big book instructions are being specific. It's not about sharing our weird behavior patterns. It's about the struggles we made to stop that illustrate powerlessness. And so this list here on the left, a lot of these are mentioned in your big book. If you think the big book is 43 pages on step one, plus the doctor's opinion, the forewords, and the preface, it's a lot of material to cover. And if you're working with someone where lack of power is their dilemma and they got only days before they go out again, going through 43 pages of your big book might be daunting. So this list summarizes the big book in 3/4 of a page. Now that's to our advantage as sponsors, because we want to move the newcomer through step one as quickly as possible, because we die on step one. You know, the first log I burned was the willpower log, the resolution, the promise, the oath. Controlled using or drinking, I burned that log early too. Harm reduction didn't work. I got off the needle by drinking. When I couldn't drink, I smoked dope. When I got bored with the dope, I went back to the drinking and the using. It failed me as a log. I had liver disease. My doctor, ominous warning, says, Cameron, you got liver disease. You got to stop drinking or you're going to die. I drank for 3 more years on that news. The first thought was, oh my God, I need a drink right now, right? Logs. Change of environment, counseling, therapy, etc. And so when I work with the newcomer, I share all the logs I've burned, and I've burned every one of these logs, and they share the logs they've burned. And we begin to realize, hey, you're just as powerless as I am. And we start to make this connection. And we start to understand one another and our problem with what we love to do. Unfortunately, it wasn't the first part of step one that drove me into the rooms. It was the second part, the loser list. Now, when I qualify someone, I ask the question, are you a loser? They don't like that. They get upset. My counselor says I suffer low self-esteem. Why would you say that? My mother called me a loser. My, you know, spouse thinks I'm a loser. I don't do it to be mean. I'm trying to wake them up. I ask them, based on your log list, what's the likelihood you're going to drink or use again? And they look at it and they go, probably 100%. Well, let's look at the record. What are you losing when you're out there in your addiction pattern? Now, I lost everything in my loser list with the exception of my license, because I never learned to drive. But I lost everything else. Now, the log list tells me how powerless the newcomer is as a sponsor. And for the sponsee, they begin to crystallize just how powerless they are, that they are beyond human aid. Nothing secular, nothing human is going to stop them. But it's the loser list that gives me the grave account. How grave, how urgent is their situation? How close to the gates of insanity or death are they at? And for the newcomer, it really, it's like a sucker punch. Oh my God, I will drink and use again, and I will lose pursuing my love of drinking and using to the gates of sanity or death. That's the horrible conclusion of step one, and we're able to do that in 3/4 of a page. Here's the one last thing I want to say about a log and loser list. It's universal. All drug addicts, all alcoholics, sex addicts, cutters, hoarders, gamblers, whatever the addiction pattern, they all burn the same logs. They all lose the same things. So as a way of identifying with one another, it's a great leveler. Rather than to try and identify on specific behavior patterns, I look at the failed strategies and what they've lost. Next time you work with someone, try it. I think you'll be pretty impressed with the results and the identification that you get from them. And now we can do those diagnosing questions. If when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely. Now, here's how I use their log and loser list. I use their MO. Do you honestly want to stop drinking or using? Yes. And based on your log list, have you been able to stay stopped? Well, no. And if when drinking or using, you have little control of the amount you take, you're probably an addict. Do you exhibit little control when drinking, using, or acting out? Yeah, I do. Well, if that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness, which only a spiritual experience will conquer, meaning I'm a loser without it. And that brings us top of page six. Now, this is by no means a comprehensive picture of the true addict, since our behavior patterns do vary, but this log and loser list should basically identify them roughly. So based on your log and loser list, does this description of an alcoholic describe you? In most of the cases, I get a resounding, yeah, it does. So now we can take them to the instruction, self-diagnosis. We had to learn to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were addicts. You don't need to confess it to me. Who are we trying to defeat? The liar. That's what we're trying to defeat. Do you fully concede, no half measures, the fact that you're an addict? Yes or no? And if that's a yes, this is the first step in recovery, and the delusion, the lie. And remember this, the liar tries to create doubt. Even to this day, 20 years in, someone came up and says, Cameron, are you really an alcoholic? Because you're really kind of a high bottom. And my brain starts going, yeah, really? Am I really an alcoholic? It's been 20 years. Maybe I should go to the bar and try a bourbon. That's the way my brain works. But it's my log and loser list that really rams home the point that I can't safely do that. The liar likes to create doubt that I'm like other people, like the muggles. And that has to be smashed and re-smashed with our program. Are you convinced you're a real addict? And that means you've taken step one. Now, I got good news and bad news. So I'm going to give you the bad news first. The bad news is we are without defense against the first drink or drug. Why? Because the liar always wins the argument. Based on your log list, is that your experience? The idea or the lie, remembering the liar creates doubt, that somehow someday we'll be able to control and enjoy our drinking and using is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker or user. That's me. And over any considerable period, I get worse, never better. And I pursue the love of drinking and using to the gates of insanity or death. And here's a problem in drying out when I'm in sobriety. When my mind and body heals, the liar returns and tells me it's okay to drink, use, or act out again. That's the bad news. It says now you're properly armed with the facts about yourself. Congratulations, you're going to die. Now, unfortunately, that's all I hear in the rooms. A lot of the rooms, it's nothing but bad news. But that's not what the rooms are for. The rooms should be about the good news. There's a way out. There is a solution. That's what we should be talking about in the rooms. Like my good friend Chris Raymer would say, the room should be a pep rally for God itself. We got a divine solution. And that's the good news. There is a solution. And if you're seriously addicted as we were, we believe there's no middle-of-the-road solution. Why? Because middle-of-the-road solutions are logs. Would you agree with that? I do. If you do, circle yes. We were in a position where life's becoming impossible. Based on your loser list, is life becoming impossible? The pain and the suffering is what drove me seeking a solution. Yeah, it's becoming impossible. And if we passed into a region from which there is no return through human aid, based on your log list, are you beyond human aid? I'm beyond human aid. I can't think of anything human or secular that will stop me from drinking or using. So we have but two alternatives. These are the crossroads, the jumping off place, the turning point, our proverbial bottom. One's to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation, which is my loser list, as best I could, and the others to accept spiritual help. And this I did because I was honestly willing to make the effort. Are you ready to accept spiritual help? And are you willing to make the effort? Yes or no? And I love this last passage. And strange as it may seem to those who do not understand, like the muggles, once the psychic change has occurred, that very same person who seemed such a loser, who was so doomed, they had so many problems they despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control their desire for drugs or alcohol. And the only effort necessary, no half measures, is being required to follow a few simple rules, our recovery recipe. You do that kind of a presentation for a prospect who's trying to understand their condition. I guarantee you at the end of it, they're going to go, I'm like you. You're like me. You don't do it anymore. And I want what you got if you got someone who's at those crossroads. Now, in order to recover, you got to have certain things in place. And to talk about, our next speaker, Bianca, is going to come up. She's going to introduce the essentials of recovery and then share with us where do we find that power, and step three, what's the decision we have to make. So Bianca, you are up.